Welcome to the second podcast of Emmanuel Reads, What the Sabbath Means to Me, a panel discussion featuring Lydia Kukoff, Julie Salomon, and Maxwell Moss. Emmanuel Reads is a community learning experience. The entire congregation spends the better part of a year reading one book, studying its meaning and significance. Lectures, panel discussions, and a Shabbaton enhance our discussions. The book selected for the 2007-2008 program is The Sabbath, Its Meaning for Modern Man, written by the preeminent theologian, philosopher, and social activist, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. We are podcasting from the Leventritt Room at Temple Emmanuel in New York City.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Stabler, librarian of the Ivan M. Stettenheim Library of Temple Emmanuel and coordinator of the Emmanuel Reads program. It is my great privilege to welcome you all tonight to Congregation Emmanuel of the City of New York on behalf of our senior rabbi, Dr. David M. Posner, and Mrs. Marcia Waxman, President of the Board of Trustees. This is the third event in this year's Emmanuel Reads, and this is a panel discussion on the topic, What the Sabbath Means to Me, featuring Lydia Kukoff, Maxwell Moss, and Julie Salomon. Lydia Kukoff, author with Rabbi Steven Einstein of Introduction to Judaism, a source book, is also the author of Choosing Judaism and Every Person's Guide to Judaism. She is the former director of the Commission on Reform Jewish Outreach and a former director of the Avichai Foundation. A founder and president of the Chatham Synagogue, Ms. Kukoff consults on synagogue change. Julie Salomon, a former cultural critic for the New York Times, is the author of six books, including The Devil's Candy and Rambam's Ladder, A Meditation on Generosity and Why It is Necessary to Give. She is the chair of a social services organization in New York City that provides care for people who are homeless and may suffer from addiction or mental disease. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Vogue, Bazaar, and The New Republic. Maxwell Moss, a member of Temple Emmanuel, inspired the Emmanuel Reads programs. He is the former president of Temple Isaiah in Forest Hills, New York, and past president of the Men's Club both here at Emmanuel and at Temple Isaiah. And Emmanuel Reads is a community learning experience. The entire congregation spends the better part of a year reading one book, studying its meaning and significance. Lectures, panel discussions, and a Shabbaton enhance our discussions. The book selected for our 2007-2008 program is The Sabbath, Its Meaning for Modern Man, written by the preeminent theologian, philosopher, and social activist, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. We have many more inspiring programs for you this coming year. Please join us on Tuesday, March 25th, to hear Stephen Brand talk about and show us his work in progress, a film entitled Praying with My Legs, a two-hour documentary about the life, thought, and transformative impact of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Next month, Rabbi Leon Morris, Executive Director, Skirball Center for Adult Jewish Learning here at Temple Emmanuel, will teach a three-week mini-course called Israel's Heritage, The Meaning of the Sabbath for Reform Jews. It will be held on April 1st, 8th, and 15th. Emmanuel Reads will conclude with a lecture by scholar-in-residence Michael Marmer on Thursday, May 1st, sponsored by the Skirball Center for Adult Jewish Learning, and it's called In Search of Heschel. Marmer will discuss Heschel's importance for a Reform Jewish movement undergoing change and for Israel at 60. Please look in your weekly bulletin or check the website at www.emmanuelnyc.org for more details. I'd like to thank Daron Rusquet, who's making it possible for us to podcast this discussion. Because this event will be podcast, during the discussion period, I ask that you either come up to the microphone or allow me to repeat your questions for the speakers. Thank you very much.
I guess we're going to speak in the order that we were introduced. Huh? Okay, thank you. I'm very happy to be with you this evening. And as I was trying to think of what to say, so much came at me, and I thought, well, where do I start? And I thought, I'm going to start with my Shabbat table. That's always a very good place to start. And I was thinking about my Shabbat table and what's on it. So I thought about the Kiddush cup that we use, which is one that I had made for my husband when we were married 25 years, and I had it made by a wonderful silversmith, and it's his interpretation of a midrash that says the Sabbath is like a flower, and the bottom of the cup comes out like a flower, which also catches drips, so it's very practical. And it has around it the inscription, Kos Yeshua Esa, the cup of foundation I will of salvation I will raise, which is something that we say as we end the Sabbath, but it's also a bit from his a part of a verse from his Bar Mitzvah Haftorah. So I was thinking about the Shabbat cover, the challah cover. Which one will it be? Will it be the one that we bought when we went to the synagogue in Florence, the main synagogue in Florence, which was a wonderful trip? And this is a very simple little white one, and it's embroidered by the women of the synagogue. And so it not only connects me to the memories of that wonderful trip to Florence, but it also reminds me of when I was a student and I lived in Florence and studied there, and it also connects me to my Italian heritage. Or will it be the one with the pomegranates, which I love? I love pomegranates, which was given to us by very dear friends who are Israeli, and of course that also reminds me of Israel, and it reminds me of them and the time in our lives when we were all very young people living, young families living in Los Angeles together, all of us without family, and became each other's family. Or will it be the one that was made by a very dear friend in Santa Barbara, Lori Gross, who is a master weaver, a very simple one that almost looks as if it were a dish towel until you look at it very closely, and you see that it's a beautiful piece of woven linen, and into which she has incorporated the Hebrew letters for Shabbat, the Shin, Beit, and Taf. And it's just incorporated into the very fabric of the challah cover. And I see that also as the way that Shabbat has become woven into my life. And so when I look at my Shabbat table, I am sort of overcome with all the memories and associations of all those years of using all of those ritual objects. But it wasn't always so, because as a Jew by choice, I started my life as an adult with no Jewish memories. And so Jewishly, at the beginning, I had no role model for myself in my own experience. I had no Jewish memories. I didn't have a Jewish memory bank. As Jewish tradition teaches, I was seen to be a newborn, but I was a newborn in an adult body, and there was a bit of a dissonance there. So I had now chosen Judaism, and Judaism was now mine, but where to start? I knew I had to continue learning, and I also knew that I had to begin to gain Jewish experience. So doing Jewish became very important to me from the beginning. I was living at that time, we had just moved to Los Angeles, we had young children, there were no family, we had no family there with us, we didn't know anybody in the beginning, and slowly but surely we managed to gather together with a group of American and Israeli friends in a similar situation, and we became each other's families. We cooked together, we shared stories of our lives, and as we cooked, I not only learned their recipes, but I heard their memories of growing up in Brooklyn or Chicago or Jerusalem. And I sort of appropriated their memories in the beginning as my Jewish memories, as well as the memories of weekly cooking with them as we would prepare for Shabbat. So already Shabbat was becoming part of my life and part of my family's life. Little by little, I became more comfortable with the doing of it. I would master one element and then go on. And I think in the beginning also, I was very concerned, was I doing it properly? You know, was this the right thing to do? Was this, you know, because of course, I didn't want to do the wrong thing, or I didn't want to make a mistake, and that was a little bit, you know, of a tricky beginning. But basically, once I got over that, I got lots of practice, because Shabbat is our most regular holiday. It happens every week, and we get lots of practice doing it, which is very good, because the more you do it, the more you do it. So we began by making a commitment to Shabbat, starting out with Friday night. So Friday night stopped being Friday night, and it became Erev Shabbat. And we stayed home with our family and had Shabbat dinner and invited people, or we were invited. And we would only go out if we were invited for Shabbat. And it became a time for family and friends and a time to breathe. And I found myself even getting into the preparation for it leading up to it. So pretty soon, I was developing a bit of a Shabbat rhythm, and that was really fun. And people knew that, you know, Friday night was not Friday night, it was Erev Shabbat. And then pretty soon, Erev Shabbat turned into Shabbat day, and going to services in the morning, and then the luxury of Shabbat lunch, which, of course, since we were in L.A., was pretty terrific, because we had a pool, and we could sit out back and, and have Shabbat lunch by the pool. And over the years, we've experienced Shabbat in many places, all the places we've lived. In L.A. with the, you know, as we used to call it, our pre-Shabbat mikvah, which was jumping into the pool before Shabbat dinner, which was a lot of fun, and the kids really got into it too, and Shabbat lunch, and the families with the kids. And you know, Shabbat has been different things at different times. It sort of evolves as we have evolved, and our life has evolved and changed. It changes with us. So now we've been for a while in the empty nester years, and for a while we lived in Jerusalem, and of course, you know, the rhythm of Shabbat in Jerusalem is all around. One doesn't have to do too much. It really literally is in the air. And again, in the country where we now also live, besides the city, where we began again with trying to figure out what Shabbat in the country looks like. And you heard, we helped found the synagogue up there, and also the challenge of taking a disparate group of people who really didn't know each other to meld us into a community, and to try to decide also on the communal level, what does Shabbat mean to the whole community? What does it look like here? What do we do? How can we decide as a community? So wherever we've been, in all the places, there are the elements, though, that are sort of constant and that are interwoven. The specialness of the day, its uniqueness, the difference from the week, the fact that it comes every week and it frames the week, the fact that it has, for us at least, always the element of community in some way, whether it's friends or our community or family, because like most of Judaism, it's very, very hard to be a Jew alone. To do Jewish alone, it's not that it's not doable, but it's certainly more difficult. Judaism is made to be experienced not just on the personal level, but especially on the more than one level, on the community level, and it's such an important part of Judaism. And I find also the services, which give its structure, the home experience gives it a certain kind of structure, and it balances with the synagogue experience. So Shabbat belongs to us. It's our heritage, but each of us has to find, I think, a way to claim it. And I think in order to own it, we have to do it. It's wonderful. I think it's so great to study about it and to learn about it, and to go to services, but ultimately we really, I think, are the richer for bringing it into our lives in some way. And I think each of us can find a way to come to own it. How? I think in a similar way that was my experience, to make the commitment to start somewhere. You know, when I first started being Jewish, I thought, well, I have to do everything now. You know, I'm Jewish, and I have to do every single thing all at once perfectly. And that really, you know, it sort of slowed down my progress in the beginning. So I think the idea of one thing at a time, and just to make the commitment to start somewhere and do one small step toward Shabbat, learn one blessing, then another. Commit to making Friday night Erev Shabbat in some way that's meaningful for you. Start with one a month and then add. Invite family and friends, or go figure out a way. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to make a 12-course dinner, but find a way to make it special. And it really is never too late to start. You know, somebody said to me, well, I can't do it. You know, I really wasn't brought up that way. I really wasn't brought up with it, so I can't do it. And I said, listen, you know, I'm the greatest living, walking testimony to somebody who wasn't brought up that way. And I can do it. And if I can do it, everybody can do it. Because there's no mystique, you know, nothing magical happens in a Jewish birth canal that says, okay, everybody now is going to be born, and you will immediately, instantly know everything. It's a function of acculturation. It's a function of acculturation. So as a Jew by choice, I began my Jewish life as an adult with no Jewish memories. And that's really not such a different place than from where many people who are born Jewish start. Often, many have little experience of Jewish life or of Judaism. And even though some have had more, regardless, in a very real sense, we're all Jews by choice, really. It's just that some of us have had Jewish parents and some of us haven't had. Because anybody who is choosing to live as a Jew in this world, where it is a world and a universe of choices, is a Jew by choice, by virtue of the fact that you've made the choice to do that, to live as a Jew. So, and also as a liberal Jew, as well as a Jew by choice, I've had to deal also with the issue of authenticity. Julie and I were talking before about that, of saying, well, you know, it's hard. You know, we don't have, as liberal Jews, we don't, you know, it's not, okay, here's the structure, and this is what you do. And everybody does it. The whole community does it. You have a framework, and everybody else in the community is doing it. And you know what to do, and you may have different variations here and there, but you everybody's doing it. Well, we're out there sort of semi without a net, and I'm sure Leon Morris will be talking about that more. And I mean, to me, it's an opportunity. To me, that's why I like being a liberal Jew. I can find my way with it. It means I have to learn, I have to think about it, I have to figure it out. But ultimately, the freedom for me is very exciting, but sometimes it's daunting because you really don't know where to start. And it does bring up issues of authenticity because I'm often asked, you know, what does it mean to be authentic? You know, and I have to say that my own sense of authenticity did not come with my conversion ceremony. You know, that was a Jewish legal reality, but it certainly was, you know, though I was legally a Jew, that was not my existential reality. I had to really gain the sense of authenticity and develop it over time as I lived my Jewish life, from study, from living in community, from doing Jewish, from having Jewish experiences, from coming to own Judaism. And bit by bit, you know, I'm a Jew in a way that has come to feel meaningful to me and comfortable to me and life-enhancing to me. I'm a formerly Italian Baptist, a Jew, a liberal Jew, who loves the tradition and who has found her authentic self in the journey that brought me from an Italian ghetto in South Philadelphia to speak to you this evening. You know, I've been a Jew for 43 years. That's longer than I've been anything else. And it's really a lifetime. It's a lifetime. It's like when I look at my Shabbat table, it's a lifetime of experiences and memories and associations that just flood over me. So, you know, just as that Shabbat table is adorned with these ritual objects that bring me this lifetime of memories and associations. The meals also that I serve are filled with memories and association. My Italian grandmother's chicken soup dwells very, very well with matzo balls in it, you know, along with Abigail's Jerusalem kugel and my mother's broccoli with garlic and olive oil. They all come from a lifetime of experiences and relationships that are uniquely mine. And though I started my Jewish life hearing and learning from other people's experiences and memories, 43 years later, I have many, many of that are my own, that are my own primary memories. And that gives me the sense of authenticity. I'm a Jew in my way. And each of us can find the way that we can be authentically Jewish, that is the way that creates our own sense of authenticity. Nobody can tell me I'm not authentic. I'm not Jewishly authentic because I own it. And so it comes from that place. And so these very, very many, many memories of my own that I have of so many Shabbatot in so many places in the world with my friends, with my family, and so many people beloved to me. And I know I've made memories for my family. I've made memories that shaped their lives as adults. My son married a Jewish woman who had no Jewish background. And for them, in the same way that we had to find our way to Shabbat, they made a choice, and it was their choice, and they do it in their way. And she learned, and she wanted to learn, and it's a great joy to me to see what goes on. And my daughter married a man who chose Judaism. And in fact, one of the first things I got him, because he was so, one of the first times he came over, he came for Shabbat dinner, and he was just enchanted. He really didn't know Jews where he grew up. There were no Jews, basically. And he said, "This is fantastic. This is fabulous. I love it." I bought him Heschel's the Sabbath. I mean, right away. So, you know, so for me to be able to sit at my children's Shabbat table and watch them bless their children on Shabbat is, for me, the greatest blessing in a life that I feel has had many, many blessings. So my hope tonight is that we can want to be memory makers for those who are dear to us and for ourselves, really. And my hope tonight is that we will always call the Sabbath a delight. Thank you very much.
Julie, go ahead.
You sure?
Yep, I'm fine.
You're fine?
Uh-oh.
I'm taking notes.
You're taking notes. Well, I love what you had to say about memory, because reading this book, which I've now probably read two or three times, and always get so much more from it about time and memory. Can you not hear me? I'm here. Is that better? Okay, I'm glad you did that so I could see you. So I did what I often do when I'm confronted with these difficult questions. I called my mother, who is spending the winter with my stepfather down in St. Petersburg, Florida, to ask her about her Shabbat memories. And because my mother is a wonderful storyteller, but she starts the very long way around. I actually typed our conversation, which I'm not going to read you. But the first line, which I will tell you so that you'll have some understanding of the long trail I have to follow my mother's storytelling, was, my memory, first of all, is that we had no bathroom in the house. So, okay. So what that was the beginning of was, just to give you a slight biographical history, because I hope somebody here is a normal Jew, because you're getting this.
Normal is
because
normal,
what is a normal Jew? So my parents grew up in Eastern Europe it was Czechoslovakia, now it's part of the Ukraine. And after the war, they ended up, after World War II, I should say, which war, they ended up in the 1950s in southern Ohio in a small town that has 800 people in it, of which there were four Jews, the two of them, my sister, and eventually me. We and everybody else in the town was one form or another of Christian, primarily Baptist, and various kind of Protestant denominations. And so, but my parents, growing up in Eastern Europe, were what we would think of as Orthodox, although my mother was, you know, was from a more modern Orthodox family. So I said, so what was Shabbat like for you? And she told this great story. It was sort of an Isaac Bashevis Singer kind of story. On Thursday night, we went to the mikveh. She went with her mother. She wasn't really allowed to go in the mikveh. She went to the, that's where they took a bath. That's how the we had no bathroom came in. They had to go once a week to take a bath there in their bedrooms. They actually had a pitcher. You know, and this wasn't in the dark ages, but it was rural Czechoslovakia in the late 1930s, I guess. And she said that it was, you know, ritual after ritual after ritual. I love your story of the Shabbat table, because she would say, you know, and on Friday we spent the whole day making challah, making cholent, making, do you know what cholent is? It's the big and, we used to call them big and little beans when it was in Ohio. And, you know, all of these details. And I thought, wow, that must have been so much easier, because, you know, you had the ritual, you had the rules, you couldn't travel on Shabbat. But then, of course, even then, a ringer was thrown into the mix, because Czechoslovakia, between the world wars, was a very liberal democracy. And my mother went to gymnasium. She went to high school eventually. And they had school 6 days a week, and the sixth day was Shabbat. So what to do? She had to go to school. So the compromise in her school was the Jewish kids. The Jews made up 20% of Hus, that town in those days. And they went to school, but they were allowed not to write. So this was the complicated thing of Shabbat. So you went to school, but you couldn't write. But then afterwards, you had to borrow the notes from your non-Jewish girlfriends to copy the notes. And she says, but I love Shabbat, because after school is over, we weren't allowed to do anything, so we just hung around the house and read. And I said, oh, would you read the Torah? She goes, no, I read novels all afternoon. So I thought, okay, she was already well en route to becoming an American Jew. And after the war, when they settled in this small town, we did every Friday. My father was the town doctor, and his office was connected to our house. And every Friday night, this is my memory of Shabbat, we had a full-blown, we lit the candles, very important, and it was very, it was kind of scary, though, because we were the only Jews in town, and so everybody was nice to us. We weren't persecuted by our neighbors, but to the contrary, quite welcome. But it was odd. So I felt, my sister and I always felt a little strange. We had this candelabra, we lit the candles, my mother made matzo ball soup, and very traditional dinner. And then immediately after dinner, my father went into the office and saw patients all evening. He saw patients every night. It was a rural area, and he was the only doctor. And my sister and I went to basketball games. And almost every Friday night after dinner, I would go and eat a hot dog as some kind of, and then every Friday night I would throw it up when I came home. So this was this weird Friday night ritual that we would go through. But then Saturday morning is my really greatest memory, because on Saturdays my dad did not have office hours. He would go into the hospital to do rounds with his patients, but he didn't have office hours. And every Saturday we read the Parsha for that week in English. We read the Torah portion. And so I got this incredible education in all of the stories of the Bible. And the funny thing is, when I called my mother the other day, she said, you know, she said at one point I was very devout as a young girl. She said, and I, you know, she would read everything in Hebrew. And I said, wow, you must have known everything up, down, and sideways. She says, you know, I never knew any of the stories till we moved to Ohio and we read those stories in English, because I didn't know what the Hebrew said. She could just read it. And all of us got this incredibly, I think, great kind of education, at least in the stories. But I think the main thing was it was the one time a week when all four of us sat in one place without having to run someplace. My father wasn't about to bolt back into the office. I wasn't bolting to the basketball game to watch. And we all just were together. And it was a really I think, not to say that my sister and I were always sitting there in devout worship. We sat there and giggled while my parents read, and, you know, we were kids, so we weren't exactly completely appreciating the text, I should say. It wasn't heavy textual studies, but it was a great moment. And so, coming from this somewhat bizarre background, and then on Sundays, until I was 6 or 7, I went to Presbyterian Sunday school, for reasons that are still somewhat mysterious to me. So I did not have a typical Jewish upbringing, to say the least, if there is such a thing. But when I grew up and I moved here and I married my husband, who had a very different kind of strange Jewish upbringing, or actually probably a very typical one, upper middle class suburb, St. Louis. His parents went to synagogue once a year for the high holidays, and at their Reform synagogue, the rabbi took people out to lunch on Yom Kippur, which was really a big leap. And the main Jewish education he and his brothers got, they did have their bar mitzvahs, and after that, their main Jewish education was marry a Jewish girl. That was it. And so he did not have a lot of Jewish knowledge at all when we've got married. And so I, on the one hand, have this weird Holocaust Eastern European Seaman, Ohio background, and he, on the other hand, has St. Louis suburbs eating lunch on Yom Kippur background. And so from this, how do you then find Shabbat? And it was interesting to hear me, to hear you talk about forming a community, because when my children are now 18 and 13, and when my daughter was born, for the first few years, we didn't belong to a temple. But we went every year to the NYU, we lived downtown, to the NYU student, which became a little awkward when we had this baby we're bringing in. You know, it seemed like maybe it's time to start growing up. But we did every Friday night light the candles. And we did have, I don't know if we even called it Shabbat dinner, because on top of everything else, I'm a vegetarian, so like all the food was no good anymore, and so we had to reinvent the kind of food you would sort of eat. But over time, I think what we started to realize that the important thing was that lighting the candle seemed very, very important, and being together as a family seemed very, very important. And then we did eventually join a synagogue. And now I'm a member of the Village Temple, and we're doing Cineplex, which I'm sure you're well aware with. And so now Shabbat's become a job, because now I'm planning the India Cineplex. And so at first I thought, is this what it's supposed to be, all these organization and detail to make this, you know, fabulous experience? But is that what Shabbat is? And reading Heschel again, I thought, yes, it is what Shabbat is. Because really, I think reading this book again reminds me all the things we're talking about, whether it's looking at your table and looking at the challah cover, or the cup that you took such care, such a beautiful story to have made, or the fact that my mother felt compelled in Seaman, Ohio, to sit us down, even to this kind of bizarre but important Friday night dinner, and then together. I think the journey is definitely what Shabbat is about. And Heschel writes about that in so many moving ways, about Shabbat being about time, not a place. And I'm obsessed with time. Now, we were just saying, we both coincidentally just finished reading the Einstein book. And Einstein is all about time, right? Time is the ultimate mystery to those of us who are bad science people. And so I think that Shabbat exists to make you realize that the rest of your life should have meaning. And I think that idea of taking time out of time as something special, I'm not sure that it matters so much that you follow the exact ritual that's prescribed. I mean, Heschel says that bluntly, but that you take the time to think about it. And you're thinking about not what am I doing tomorrow, or what's happening, you know, with this, that, and the other kind of unimportant thing, but to really look inward and to find what is it that's pushing you through this world, and to be at peace with it, which is a lot easier, I think, said than done many times. I had a very interesting Shabbat experience year before last. I spent the last 2005, 2006, so I guess a year, I don't know, whatever that was, at Maimonides Hospital in Brooklyn, not as a patient, everything's fine, thank you, but as an observer, I got permission to spend a year watching the functioning and sometimes malfunctioning of this very interesting hospital, which is in Borough Park, big, busy hospital that is glatt kosher. 20%, 25% of the patients are still Jewish, Orthodox Jews, and then the rest is Brooklyn, 67 languages literally spoken here. So I saw the hospital as a very interesting place to look at all the issues of modern life, multiculturalism, being a Jew in the middle of a multicultural world, modern medicine, all of, in a very stressful urban situation. But the thing that was really interesting there was because it is a glatt kosher hospital, and even though it serves a very varied community at this point of many languages and many cultures, the Orthodox still hold claim on that hospital because it is still, Borough Park is still that community. And so what's fascinating was when I would be at the hospital on Fridays, it was probably a little like Jerusalem, that all of a sudden everything changed. People started scurrying around really fast and buying things. And, you know, there's a lot of activity going on, and it's exciting. I mean, you can actually feel something mm-hmm. big is about to happen. And just being there was very exhilarating in a way because something was about to happen. And within the hospital, things got very quiet on Friday night. Normally, one thing about Orthodox families, they are number one, extremely big, and number two, extremely devoted to their community. So that hospital, every patient gets 97,000 visitors every night, which is great, but it makes it very busy. And what happens on Friday night is everything quiets down, it settles out, and at one point I thought, this is really amazing because you don't feel an absence, you feel a presence. And that presence is palpable, and I would feel very jealous. I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great to be Orthodox and just have this coherence and this world? And then, of course, I would say no. But there was that moment of envy and thinking it would be so nice to have this warm place to step into. And I think exactly what you were saying. So we have to create that. And that is a different kind of excitement. So as I sit here and complain a little bit about all my tasks in organizing the India Cineplex Shabbat, it's been fascinating. And the most fascinating part is, and I'll just say one more thing and then turn it over to you, is that a year ago, my husband works for a not-for-profit organization that gives money to the poorest people in the world. So over the last few years, we've gone on vacation to the poorest places in the world with our children. And last year, we were in India, which despite all we read about the great and incredible economic development, there, Delhi, absolutely, was that feeling that, you know, the notion that here we are in New Delhi on Shabbat and the prayers we're praying are the same. And we're in this space and we're welcomed. And many of the people there were from many different kinds of backgrounds. And it was extremely, it was a place out of time, but very much in time. And I think I don't even want to say struggle. I think the excitement of Shabbat in the 21st century, which is where we are sitting right now, is a very interesting one because I think you said a very profound thing. We are Jews by choice, thank God. And, you know, we're allowed to be the choosers, not the chosen, which I think is a better place to be. And so I look forward to hearing from you and from all of you about your ideas on it. But I think it's an interesting adventure we're all on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so, too. Incidentally, I don't cook Shabbat dinner. All right. I just eat it. Lydia, it's interesting that you were in Los Angeles because we went out to Los Angeles many, many years ago. We didn't know anyone. And the first thing we did was to join Temple Isaiah.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Rabbi. There was a Rabbi Lewis there.
Lewis, this Howard goes, Lewis.
Yeah, this goes back a couple of years. And we started there. Wherever we were, we wanted to belong to a temple. I felt that's absolutely essential for a Jew, particularly. And we stayed there a few years, then we moved back to Forest Hills, and we joined another Temple Isaiah in Forest Hills. And we were there for 26, 27 years. While we were there, we didn't know anyone. And one day Dorothy says, I don't know anyone. We go to services, but the rabbi doesn't even know us. So we decided we would go every Friday night. And we went every Friday night for a solid year. We got to know people. But more important, it gave us the feeling of being part of Judaism. It was a ritual that we developed for ourselves. And because of that, whenever we missed a Friday night, we felt bad. And this was part of us. And this is what I think people will feel on the constantly going to services. You're part of the service. Then we became, eventually we moved to the city, became members of Emmanuel, and became involved with the men's club. I'll tell you a little secret. The one thing I love more than anything else in the temple, that's beside Rabbi Posner and the rabbinate, is studying Torah. This to me is more important, to me, for me anyway, than anything else. And Wendell, one of the participants in the Torah class, will verify that. I love it because when I go to Torah class and we read the Parsha and I visualize ourselves going through the same as Moses did, as Miriam did, as Aaron did, and all the biblical members of the tribe, so to speak. It is absolutely amazing. Here, a little group amongst many foreigners, Canaanites, Jebusites, foreigners who were trying to kill us, they maintained that group, that tribe, and traveled and remained together. It was amazing. And I don't know how they did it. I don't think anyone does. And when the Bible says there was 603,000 Jews leaving Egypt after 400 years living in bondage, I don't believe there was 603,000. That's a lot. Moses would have had to have a loud voice or a big amplifier to keep these people going. And what gets me is that people miss so much by not questioning it, reading it. When Moses went up to Mount Sinai and spent 40 days and nights there and came back and saw his brother, hey, what'd you do? Well, I built a nice golden calf. What do you think? Well, there's a lot of story in that. And why was 3,000 of the Jews killed? Because they were praying to the golden calf. What, you know, we miss so much. And even today, with all the astute scholars giving us information about the Torah, we don't even know. We don't even know. But I can only visualize, and I want to be part of that group and feel that group in developing our religion. It's amazing. A little tribe getting together. And Abraham and Sarah. I got a story, a midrash about Abraham and Sarah. You know when Abraham took Isaac up to the mountain to be killed because Sarah didn't talk to him after that. When he came back, I can only visualize Sarah saying, what did you do? You took my only son up to this Mishigas God and you try to kill him. And I don't want to see you anymore. Well, sure enough, she didn't talk to him again, and that was it. But there are so many stories that that you can become part of in developing our religion. True, all the accoutrements, all the festivals, and everything else is important. But if you don't have that key, that desire to know or feel what went on with our brethren, you're missing the essence of Judaism. And this is what that's what I feel. I know it's short, but this is a point that I wanted to get across.
That's a very good point.
Questions?
I mean, I actually, it's not a question, but I totally agree with you because, as I said, I feel like reading those parshas as a kid was so important because one of the things that worries me a little bit about the cineplexes and all of that, which are all wonderful, but they don't teach people the basis. And I think it has to be hand in glove or else, or hand in hand, something.
I can't agree with you more. I do a lot of work with synagogues, so.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's all great and it's all wonderful, but the truth is, it's been a fascinating experience starting a synagogue. And it really has been because we started a synagogue in a place we really hadn't lived for very long. And when we first moved there, in fact, I didn't think there were any Jews there whatsoever. And I said, well, if we get lonely, we'll just import our friends from the city. And what happened was, and one of the most exciting things, one of the very most exciting things has been one of the things we do, and again, you know, disparate, I mean, Jews, you know, sort of came out, we've grown from like 10 households in about 7 years to 100 households. And the truth is, one of the most exciting things we do, which most people have never done, is that every week on Shabbat morning, we ourselves, at a certain point in the service, instead of chanting from the Torah, taking the Torah scroll out, we gather around a table and we read the entire portion in English. Mm-hmm. And for about an hour and a half, we wrestle with it and we engage mm-hmm. with it. We don't have a rabbi. We do it ourselves. And anybody who walks in can feel that they have something mm-hmm. to bring to it, if it's a question or a comment or something from their own life. And it's exactly what you said. It is the strength and the power. And that has been so transformational in the lives of our people, our congregants, our members. They wouldn't miss it. And these are people who were not shul goers, most of them. Mm-hmm. They never went to synagogue. They never did. You know, they come from all kinds of backgrounds. They wouldn't miss it. They would not miss it. They come every week. We have a huge attendance in this little synagogue in the country. And it's because of that, they have been given, they've been given their narrative back. They've been given their formational narrative stories, what makes us us. And not only that, but it isn't just those stories. It's exactly what you say. The act of wrestling with it and questioning it and questioning each other around it, people's faces glow. It's just thrilling. It's just the best.
I know, it's pretty interesting. My son is now, he just had his bar mitzvah a couple months ago, and he's in this Beit Midrash class, and they were going through all these different things, the kids should do this and this and this, and then some of the parents said, why don't they just pick up something from the Torah and right. do that, and the kids have actually loved it because mm-hmm. they like to argue. They like to argue.
The material too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean they're great stories.
Yeah, kids love it. Agree.
Well, this is our strength: the fact that we can go back and find our heritage, 2,000, 3,000 years ago. We're still one family. No matter how far we travel, or no matter what we do, we are still one family. Unfortunately, Hitler told us that. You're still Jews, and that was it, no matter what you do. So it's a heritage that I think the temples should try to develop more, an interest on the part of their congregants. This is what is going to hold us together. It's held us together for 2,000 years. It'll do for another 2,000.
Somebody had a question. Thanks.
We belong to Temple Manuel, but we have a house in Cold Spring, little house, and we have a little Phillipstown Reform synagogue in the Episcopal Church, St. Mary's there. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about it is about half the families are Jewish women married to non-Jewish people. And the Episcopal Church is just going crazy over the synagogue. they've taken off the Avatara, and they, which we got from Brooklyn somewhere, which came from Europe. And he's, when he heard that we have Avatara somewhere else, he said, no, you have to bring it here. And somebody wrote a thesis by building an ark for the Torah.
Right.
And it was kind of, and I was just thinking, Ms. Kuka, that he mentioned they would take the Parsha, and without synagogue would also, we'd have somebody leading a discussion at 9:30 and then the synagogue service at 10:30. Parsha was second. First was if you could pick a top, a Jewish topic. So we do the Kabbalah, we do oral law and Jewish law, and somebody could lead the discussion. It was kind of interesting because we get into topics as well as Parsha. You know? But I was wondering, if all three of you have some, how did Heschel affect you? The Sabbath, I guess you all read the book.
Yeah.
How did he affect you personally?
Well, I mean, we were saying the two of we were when Julie and I were speaking earlier, just schmoozing like that. We were saying I first read it many years ago, and I was floored by it. I was just floored by it, and it's something that I read over and over again. Every so often, because it's that kind of, it's a meditation, I think. I don't even know what to say about it, because Heschel is so amazing. He's such an amazing thinker and writer and human being, and you feel all of that when you read it. It really encapsulates what the Sabbath is about in the most, I don't know, I just find it so moving every time I read it, and I find different things in it.
Yeah, no, I feel that too. I mean, I had read it, I had originally come to it because when I first went, well, before I went to Maimonides, I'd written a book that dealt with Maimonides, and Heschel wrote the classic biography of Maimonides, and so I had read that, which I really loved, and then a friend actually gave me this book. I can't even remember on what occasion, like 3 or 4 years ago. And I read it then, and I really loved it. But then when I was out at Maimonides Hospital, and I had this whole experience of being there in the neighborhood, I reread it. And as you can see, it's pretty well posted it up, because I just felt that a lot of things that Heschel wrote about were so moving and so much like poetry that they really hit the inside. And I think a lot of the things that we've all been talking about, he addresses in such a beautiful way. And I think just a lot of kind of philosophical points, I guess, that I had been debating with myself, I just felt like, oh, he must have been inside my mind because he's sort of addressing them. I think that he really, in a very accessible way, even though it's very dense and you can't read it very quickly, but I think his for somebody who's such a learned man, he's so in touch with his emotion and with a wider stream of emotion that I think the book is very, very beautiful and profound.
Mm. No comment.
You didn't like
it? No, I didn't finish it.
And also, I thought the introduction by his daughter, who I think spoke here, mm-hmm. I thought her introduction was also so beautiful. Mm-hmm. They were also in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. You didn't finish it because you were
emotional? No, I didn't finish it because our readers group had other books I had to finish. I have to have priorities.
Yeah.
Right there. Michael.
I was just wondering the role of Shabbat is in Jewish life, in our Jewish life. And someone once said, I think it was a Haraam, that more than the Jews making the Sabbath,
keeping
the Sabbath has kept Jews.
Kept Jews.
Mm-hmm. wonder if you respond to that, and you know, what does that mean, and what does that mean to us today, looking around at our Jewish world?
I think the question is that that what is the if does the Jew make Shabbat or Shabbat make the Jews, and how in the modern world do we help keep that special place of Shabbat in maintaining the Jewish community?
Yeah, and to what extent doesn't Shabbat in fact serve as the glue that Max mentioned before that gives us a coherent Judaism?
Well, I think you kind of addressed it initially, which were both of you, to say that, you know, I mean, I come from a sort of having been on both sides of the fence. I mean, as a child, Shabbat was very internal. It was very much my family, but feeling connected to some larger Jewish community through celebrating it as a family. But I have to say, because my parents were Holocaust survivors, so much of what Judaism was it was a double-edged sword. On the one hand, they made it a very joyful thing and a very familial thing, but it was also associated with such terrible, horrible loss that I think as a child it was very hard to sort of reconcile those two things. As an adult joining the synagogue, I mean, my husband, who came from this, you know, sort of Jewish but not at all observant family, you know, eventually became the president of our synagogue, and I think really loves it. And I think what my children have had that neither one of us had is that sense of Shabbat being part of our family but part of a larger community, not just in India but actually here in Greenwich Village where we live. And there is something incredible about that, and I think that over the years, like you said, going every week, I asked my mother, then I asked my son just to make sure I had generational continuity. So I said, Eli, what does Shabbat mean to you? And I said, how do you feel we celebrate Shabbat? He said, well, for me, it's the time when we're together as a family, but then we go to the synagogue, not every week, but pretty frequently. And he says, and I really like being there. And, you know, you know, which doesn't mean that there aren't weeks that he doesn't go, but I think there is that sense of being part of something larger that's really, but that's also very intimate. So it's that sort of dichotomy that I think is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a struggle to keep it alive. And I think, how do you maintain both the learning, the entertainment, I think anybody who's had that experience where it's Friday and you've had a really hard week and you step inside the synagogue and it changes. Everything just kind of quiets down. You feel your pulse slowing down and you're focused on something else. And I think that's a really amazing thing.
Yeah, I think I do think it is a genius of Judaism to have come up with the Sabbath. I mean, we really did that. I mean, I'm not a Jewish triumphalist by any means, but I like it a lot. You know, I chose it after all. And the truth is that, I think exactly this idea of being, it contextualizes us. You know, we live such fragmented lives. We all are so part of so many things, so many different kinds of communities and families that are varied and all over the place and busy, and you know, all of that. We know all that about modern life, and especially it seems to get only more so. Everything is sped up, and you know, and really there really is a lack of coherence, and we struggle for coherence and we struggle for context. And it seems to me that Shabbat, and this is something I learned actually when I was at the foundation, when I worked largely with people who were really quite Orthodox, and we would talk and they would say, you know, we're really not in charge of the world. We're really not in charge of the world. And I think a lot of times we live our lives as though we are in charge of the world, or we try to be in charge of the world. And I always used to jokingly say, control is an illusion. I know that rationally, but underneath, I really have in me, I want to control things and do things, you know, and have it all be, you know, and I, you know, at a certain point, give over already. And I think Shabbat teaches us that every week, you know, and I think Heschel, that's one of the great things that Heschel, I think, articulates so well about building palaces in time, and about the idea that we are not in control of everything, and it's okay to say, you know what, I'm off duty. I am off duty, except in the most life-enhancing ways, you know, and that means family or friends or whatever is important to me. And I think even though we may have different ways of doing it, and we do, in fact, and Jews do, and we certainly as liberal Jews do, it's still, there is still the context that it gives us. There's still within that a sense of coherence but not control. And I think that's a freedom. And I think Shabbat really is about freedom. And I think that's what was so radical in ancient times when we came up with it in the first place. It was a very radical notion in its time. Nobody had anything like that. Just let it go. And I think it's still radical for us today.
Very good. Now, I think God got tired after 6 days. And, rest, and that's why we have a Shabbat. I'll tell you, the basic reason why I like Shabbat from the standpoint, I come into the sanctuary, I forget about the secular problems, I just relax. I don't have to make an impression on anyone. And if I want to close my eyes and Dorothy keeps poking me, don't go to sleep. I enjoy the service. I enjoy the calmness of it. And I know what's coming. It's a relaxing part of my week. It really is. And I look forward to it. That's my answer. Yes?
It seems that I'm also from Cold Spring. This is my very sweet wife. Probably come today. I think the Sabbath really has created the Jewish culture, and the thing that it really has given us, I think, has been talking to each other. I mean, this world would be a much different place if people really talked to each other. And even if a person isn't very observant in a sense, to have the parents, even if they are not observant, in some sense, even though my parents were kosher butchers, but they had to be quiet about anything else they did. But the thing is, by talking, you reason out the way you get along with people, and it goes through the person. The person becomes a better person, and many Jews, that's why the Jews have created so much in this world, because they think things out. And I think this is really the wonderful thing about Judaism, and the Sabbath has preserved that thing. And then eventually you get back to creating a little synagogue where you really talk to people. And I think something wonderful about Temple Emmanuel is happening with Rabbi Posner, that people are talking to each other in a wonderful way. And we're torn between Cold Spring and also Temple Emmanuel. Of course, we need both, which makes it a little harder. I think this is what we have to do. We can settle a lot of the problems of the world. If people would only talk, they'd see ways of doing things. And the kindness comes through people. Even though you don't have the religious favor, you just have the attitude and you don't know why. I find some of my own attitudes are the same as some of the things I heard when my wife led a discussion on the history of Judaism and how the rabbis developed the Torah and the attitude. The world eventually will be a better place if we can keep talking, but I don't know, we have to do more. Sorry, but it's almost a question. I don't know.
No,
questions, statements, everything welcome.
I'm going to speak in the microphone. What I've been most moved about your discussion is the way you've connected the Sabbath and Torah, and the idea of, you know, a palace in time, but also a telescope backwards and then forwards.
that the Torah provides. So I think that's very exciting, and I hope that everyone gets to listen to this podcast. And I thank you all. It was just really wonderful.
Thank you.